You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes. On today's episode, we are joined by writer-director Vincenzo Natali for a discussion of Stanley Kubrick's 1971 feature film, A Clockwork Orange. Set in a dystopian Britain of the near future, A Clockwork Orange is based on Anthony Burgess's 1962 novel of the same name. Half a century later, it remains a controversial cult classic due to its depictions of graphic violence. The film follows Alex, played by Malcolm McDowell, a young social delinquent, and his small gang of thugs, whom he calls his droogs. They commit various acts of ultra-violence while fighting rival gangs under the influence of a barbiturate spiked milk. They talk to each other using Nadsat, a slang mixing Russian and Cockney English. After committing one violent crime too many, Alex is sent to a prison where he becomes the guinea pig for a new rehabilitation technique known as the Ludovico technique. Operatic, choreographic, shocking, beautifully constructed and acted, A Clockwork Orange hasn't lost any of its initial power. Our guest Vincenzo Natali tells us why the film has had such an influence on him from a young age.
Vincenzo Natali is a Toronto-based writer-director known for science fiction and horror films such as Cube, Splice, and In the Tall Grass, as well as TV series Hannibal and the Amazon Prime adaptation of William Gibson's The Peripheral and Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities. Tech is his first foray into the realm of graphic novels.
Welcome, Vincenzo Natali, to After Images podcast. We're delighted that you could join us today for a discussion of Stanley Kubrick's 1971 A Clockwork Orange.
Oh, thank you, Marisa. Thank you, Franck.
Yeah, it's great to
this
have you.
This is going
to
be fun. I've never spoken about Clockwork Orange. This is, and it's a very important film to me, so I'm so happy to do this.
Well, let's start there. Why is the film important to you, and why did you suggest it today? And can you maybe recall the context in which you first discovered the film?
Yeah, I discovered the movie pretty early on, I think, because of my vintage, meaning, you know, I was a child of the 70s and 80s. It was kind of ubiquitous. Like, not even knowing what it was, I was aware of it because it was in Toronto, where I grew up, it was playing all the time. I felt like it never stopped being in theaters. And of course, in those days, you know, this is even pre-videotape. That's the only way you could see it. But unlike most movies, it was ever present. Like it might disappear for a while, but it'd always be revived at some movie theater at some point. And I think that the name of it, the poster art, you know, which is so striking, by Philip Castle, has stuck with me somehow. And I was curious, because what the hell is A Clockwork Orange? It's such a strange title. And so I was quite young when I saw the film for the first time, much younger than I probably should have been when I saw it. But I read the book. I remember I read the book first, because the movie was not accessible. So I read the Anthony Burgess novel when I was maybe 11 or maybe 12. And it really was taken with it, particularly because of the language, the Nadsat language. It was so fascinating to me. And so I was kind of primed for it. And then eventually I saw it on videotape. I grew up with my mom here and we didn't have a video player, but a friend of hers did, and somehow they had no issue with me watching A Clockwork Orange while the grown-ups partied downstairs, and that was how I saw it the first time, and it just really struck me. And I think I had also seen still photographs of it, because I had this really great book, I still have it somewhere, called The Encyclopedia of Science Fiction, and there was, you know, a couple key frames from it that really struck me. And there was just something about the whole pop art vibe of it that was really captivating. And then when I saw the film, I wasn't disappointed. It was just such a startling. I don't even think I really understood 100% of what I was taking in, but it kind of electrified me. And I feel like it's now it's part of my DNA. It's so deep in me, and how the way I think about things, how I think about filming, the particular the aesthetic of it, the filmmaking on many levels is very formative. And then the story, and what it's about. And I still puzzle over it a little bit. I think it's a film full of contradictions and paradoxes, and that's one of the reasons it's so controversial, because it is hard for people to separate the narrator of the film from the filmmaker's point of view. Anyway, so yeah, for all those reasons and more, it left an indelible mark.
And has your understanding and feeling about the film evolved throughout the years, or do you feel that you have kept a similar outlook towards the film?
I feel like as I've gotten older and oddly more sensitized, I find the film more upsetting. When I was a kid, I didn't bother me at all. Like all of the horrible things that happened in it just kind of washed off me. And I think it's partly because they didn't register. I wasn't mature enough for them to register with me the way I do now. And I kind of vacillate a little bit in terms of what I think the strong parts of the movie are, because the film has this incredibly dynamic first part, you could say a first act, I guess, which is really contains most of the images and moments that people talk about in the movie. But then the remaining two-thirds of the film are much more methodical and sedate. And I kind of vacillate whether that's a good thing or not. It's an interesting, it's like Apocalypse Now has like that amazing, the first part of Apocalypse Now is actually much more exciting than the second part, but the second part is much more resonant than the first part. And I think Clockwork Orange is the same way. So there's an interesting, I think maybe as I've matured, I appreciate the latter portions more than I did when I was younger. To me, when I was younger, after Alex goes to prison, things get a lot less interesting. And maybe I'm a little more receptive to that now that I'm older.
It's true that the first part has a lot of m most of the action of the film and the ultra violence that we were mentioning just a few minutes ago. But I was wondering if perhaps the fact that you were not upset about this violence when you first saw the film might have been linked to the fact that there is an element of abstraction to it. It's a bit Guignol. I mean, it's over the top and not very realistic, is it?
Yeah, and that's what I loved about it too, was the theatricality and the formalism of it. That I really responded to that. Like it is, in a way, you could say that Clockwork Orange is a musical, that it has that, it has that level of artifice to it. And then of course everything that's horrible in it is played funny. So, and from a distance. So it's not, and it's not bloody. Like I think that the what's disturbing about it is more the emotional violence. Like if you in any way connect to like the people that are being raped in this film, of course you're going to be traumatized, but the film is so distant from them, and especially when you're younger and you don't really know what that is, what that means, I think it just kind of doesn't affect you. Like I have a theory that kids are self-censoring, that like I think it was fine for me to watch A Clockwork Orange because the things that are truly disturbing about it, I didn't really get. So they just sort of washed through me. They didn't affect me badly. Didn't disturb me. They didn't make me pervert me. They just kind of went through me. And then when kids do see something that feels dangerous, like and scary, they'll actually self-censor. There's a tendency to just then shut it off or close your eyes or look away. Or so, yeah. So no, I think you're right, Frank. I think that the film doesn't really hit those chords. And with, intention, obviously, like that's what Kubrick intended. And, I reread the book this week to prepare for the podcast. And The book does exactly the same thing. I was actually shocked at how close the book is to the film. I don't think I've ever read a book that is as directly translated into a film as A Clockwork Orange. Maybe some of the Harry Potter books that I'm not as familiar with. There's, some other things like that. But it really is. There are editorial changes that have been made, and there's, some additional moments and slight alterations. But effectively, most of the dialogue is taken directly from the book, and they share and the book and both the film and the book share the same tone. It's a very jovial, energetic, youthful, lighthearted tone.
There's so much to dive into here, so I know we'll go into a lot of topics that you've just mentioned. But now that we're here talking about the book, I'm just curious what you think about the ending, because I know that that can be a bit of a controversial topic for people who interpret the film, and who certain famous critics like Pauline Kael, for example, who really regretted that that last chapter of the book was eliminated from the film's conclusion. What do you think about that? Is the book's conclusion too sweet and too moralistic for you? Do you prefer the film's ending, or how do you position yourself in that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't like that the book's ending. And as I understand it, when the book was published in America, that chapter, which is about Alex reforming, and choosing to be good, as opposed to being forced to be good, was cut out with Anthony Burgess's blessing, just because the publisher thought it would be more commercial, oddly enough, even though that's a much darker ending, to remove it. And so I don't believe that even when I read the book the first time when I was 11 years old, I don't think that chapter was included, because it would have been the North American edition. And I only just read this one, and it does feel almost disingenuous to me. I just don't think it's hard to accept that somebody like that would reform in the way that they do in the book, which is basically to decide, you know what, I don't like doing this anymore. I want to have a kid and be a nice guy, which is kind of what he says at the end. And maybe it's because what I know, what I was first introduced to, was the Kubrick film and the North American version of the book. So I'm just inclined to like what I know. But yeah, I think whether Kubrick knew about that last chapter when he made the movie or not, I think that it was the right choice to leave it out.
Yeah, I read that he didn't know at the time about that last chapter, but that when he was told about it, he thought that it was nonetheless a good idea not to include it, that the film was stronger this way. Because feeling reading the book that it felt a bit like a Deus ex machina, like God arrives and everything is going to be fine. And he didn't rhyme very well with the rest of the story, did it? That reformation of Alex all of a sudden.
No, if you, I'm not saying that Alex couldn't reform, but it would take a lot more for him to reform. Like, he just basically decides, you know what, on the without really pro any provocation, like, I don't think I like to do this anymore. So, because when you meet him again in that last chapter, he's just back in the Korova milk bar with a new set of droogs, and they're out doing bad stuff. And then he just like goes, you know what? I don't think I like this. And he basically walks away, and it feels forced. You're exactly right. It doesn't feel like there's an internal motivation. It just feels like the author feels as though that's the right thing for the character to do. No disrespect to Mr. Burgess, who's genius.
And piggybacking a bit on this question of controversy and the links to violence, what do you think about all of these debates related to what's shown, and a lot of questions or a lot of words that get thrown around, like objectification, desensitization, and lack of sensuality, or perhaps for some people, what is a sensuality represented in those scenes? What do you think about that? And maybe your relationship, as you mentioned already, has evolved in terms of a child not necessarily processing that, or processing it sort of intellectually anyway.
Did you become violent as a result of watching the film?
This is an endless debate, right?
Right.
It's an interesting one, and I do feel like movies, this is a beyond just A Clockwork Orange, I do feel like movies have an influence on culture, and therefore indirectly perhaps they do influence behavior. And I know you're asking a slightly different question, but where I fall on this is, I don't think any movie is capable of making somebody become a rapist or a murderer. You'd have to have that in you already. A rapist or murderer might like the movie. They might even quote the film, but it's not going to turn somebody into that. I don't think, same thing with, I don't think media has that much power, honestly, to affect behavior to that level. I think it has an influence, but I don't think it's, I do feel like it's a spectrum, and I don't think it, this is my layman, unscientific view of things. I don't think that it is without influence. I think we see it now in many ways. Words alone are very powerful tools, let alone a movie, a moving image with sound. And then in terms of how the film was made, like the way it treats women, the way it treats violence, I know that even at the time, like Pauline Kael wrote a scathing review, and I can't remember exactly what she said, something to the effect of like Kubrick is like a German doctor when he films sex or something like that. But kind of
Really had
making a
it
point that
in.
like it's really repulsive that he's so clinical in the way he deals with things. These things. I would make the argument that, well, yes, that's why it's so effective, because it's not, he is treating it kind of like an alien, viewing this behavior somewhat dispassionately and without comment. And I mean, he is really commenting on it, but the film's perspective is so detached. And saying I was watching it again for this, I was particularly aware of like how all the violence is seen from a great distance, like literally from the other side of the room. So you like that's not traditionally how we shoot violence, because usually when you're making a scene like that in most films, you want to get people inside the action. You want them to be participants. And Kubrick does the opposite. He it's almost like a CCTV view of the violence. So it's very much from this kind of alien, omniscient perspective, which you could either see as being perverse because it's voyeuristic, or you could see it as being actually very respectful of the audience because it's not telling them how to respond. It's letting the audience decide. But it's a uniquely Kubrickian perspective, which is part of the reason I love it so much. And then, of course, you look at all the other things that are in play, like the music and how music is almost always used ironically and for humor. And of course, I'm a guy, so I have a I don't think I'm sensitized in the way other people would be, especially women would be, and yeah. But that's. But I wasn't offended by it. Like I tried to see it from that perspective, and I don't. I could see how someone would be offended by it, but I don't feel like the film, in any way advocates what Alex is doing. I don't feel like it's an advertisement for it. But I think that it gets close enough to the line that it scares people, because it doesn't, it does find humor in what's happening. It doesn't in any way empathize with the victims. In fact, it kind of, the film seems to hold pretty much everybody in contempt. Every character, including Alex, the narrator, is viewed with very little compassion. And so I think it in some ways it takes you could, in its defense, you would say, well, it's not siding with anybody, really. It's actually very critical of every single character in this film.
But Alex is the perhaps the only one who feels alive in the film. Everyone seems it dead, cold, without passion. Whereas he has several interests in life. I mean, obviously an interest for ultra-violence, but much more interestingly, perhaps he has this very strong passion for Beethoven, which is totally against what one would expect from a character like him, isn't it?
Yeah, he's a very, you're right, he's a very seductive and appealing character because, and like Billy Boy, who is kind of his arch nemesis in the gangland world, is the opposite of him, right? Like he's dirty and he's, with uncultured and gross. Whereas Alex is, I mean, his clothes are spotless and he is in the height of fashion and he's sophisticated and cultured and smart and witty. So he is an attractive, seductive character. However, I would also say the film still, and yet the film still perceives him with, a raised eyebrow and kind of, even Alex isn't that smart. He's kind of stupid in his own way too, and the movie underlines that. Like when he gets his sort of Stanley Kubrick, like eyes rolled in the head look, like he's clearly portrayed as somebody who's off his rocker, like who's completely mad and who, is in some ways a little behind the curve in terms of what's being done to him. He's not that smart. But yes, he is alive, and he, like a Donald Trump, you might say he's repugnant, but I guess what I sorry to bring it down to this, I'm even uttering this name, but I'm constantly trying to figure out, like, why do people like him? But I think there is some kind of authenticity to him. And that people get that, like they really respond to it. And even if, he's authentically evil, and there is like an ecstasy to evil, right? There is something thrilling about seeing somebody do something that is against our better nature, and that is against polite society, and doing maybe the thing that deep down we desire to do, that the id wants to do, and they're enacting it, and that is thrilling to watch and kind of cathartic. So I think, yeah, you're right. Like Alex does all those things, and then also he's posited in a world where it feels like maybe he's in a slightly fascist future. Like there's a line where the Ministry of the Interior, or whatever he is, says, we're not having the riffraff in the prisons. We're making room for, people of a political persuasion or something to that effect, like implying, like, oh, they're going to imprison. We need to make room in the prisons for all like the political prisoners we're going to put in here. So he is in a world that's so corrupt and misguided that, by comparison, he doesn't look as bad as he should. And I even think that is where people get, really have trouble with the movie, because exactly what you say, Frank, like it makes Alex into an appealing character. But I maintain that the film doesn't advocate for Alex. I think it still looks at Alex for what he is. It sees very clearly what he is, and it doesn't hide what he is at all.
Perhaps he's just the lesser of several evils.
Right. Yes. Or the more interesting of the several evils.
This
Yeah.
occurred to me when you suggested this film for the podcast. I had a thought, being familiar with your own filmography and thinking a lot about the themes of people who are stuck or in a contained environment and finding almost seemingly impossible solutions, creating a new path that didn't exist before to get out. And even though I don't associate that level of violence with your films, I did think about the fact that Alex is creating a path outside of those kind of contained possibilities on both sides, where we see that progressives in the film, as well as conservatives in the film, corrupt to a certain extent, and he's tracing his own path. And I'm just curious if there are aspects of the film in that sense of kind of being stuck, of finding a different way that appeal to you now as an adult, or Or am I just totally interpreting that in my own way?
No, I think, well, I think the film is kind of a proto-punk film, right? Like it obviously had an influence on punk music and punk culture, which is angry and a reaction to the hypocrisy and the corruption of the world. So that's like a very gen, I hate to say I'm like so pathetically Gen X. Like I think it's a very Gen X thing related to. So I'm sure that partly that seeped into my worldview. A cynical, view, like a view of like, yeah. Whereas it probably was really a reaction to the, you know, the hippie movement, like a reaction to the failure or the disenchantment with, you know, the 1960s. But like when I look at A Clockwork Orange, it doesn't look like any other movie from that time. It really doesn't like it plays. Well, first of all, it looks like it'd be shot last week. But it doesn't, even the film stock doesn't look like 1970s film stock somehow. Maybe it's the transfers that are available, but it, the color palette, it doesn't, it's so crisp. And, you know, he's using a lot of white, pure black, primary colors or bright colors. It doesn't have that kind of gritty, dingy look that a lot of films like the French Connection came out that year, which is a marvelous film, but has like is it to me like it is like the perfect example of what movies looked like at that time, which was like it was lots of brown. It was actually the actual film stocks, you know, were very warm and they would pick out browns and grays and mid-tones and whereas Clockwork Orange feels very crisp and I wouldn't say contrasty, but almost like it was shot on a, you know, the film stocks from the 1980s, not 1970s. So that film just feels like it's out of its time in a way. And even though in some ways it is of its time, but I think, you know, another stroke of genius was that the film has no pop music in it. Like you could describe it as a youth culture film. And you know, at one time the Rolling Stones are going to be the Droogs, and I think even the Beatles. So you would have assumed like any other filmmaker would probably have put in some kind of contemporary music, even though the classical music is written into the novel. But the choice not to put contemporary music really helps make the film timeless. Like it doesn't. It's hard to place. I mean, the some of the fashions, I suppose, give it away. But other than that, you really, it's hard to identify it as being of a particular moment.
And it's interesting because the film came right after 2001, Space Odyssey. So it does have a certain feel of science fiction. I mean, it's supposed to be in the near future. But as you mentioned, it also has this no future sort of message that connected to the punk movement. And you connected this with the hippies. And I was wondering if perhaps this was not also connected with the Vietnam War and the influence of the Vietnam War being on television in the United States every evening with its actual violence. And all of a sudden, people get upset because they see fake violence in a movie. I mean, what do you think about this?
Well, I think it was an explosive time. I think it's a very similar time to right now, right? Like it felt, it must, I can't even imagine. It's probably was much even more unsettling to be alive at that time because culture changed so radically on so many different levels. And of course, yeah, there was this terrible war going on and a different kind of war than people were familiar with, or certainly presented in a way that they weren't familiar with, where it was much more visible and ugly. And you know, and you look at the other films that came out in 1971, like the Ken Russell movie, The Devils, which was released by the same studio. Like Warner Brothers put out A Clockwork Orange and The Devils the same year. Like you can't even, that's inconceivable now. You can't imagine that happening now. Or in Straw Dogs. These are very transgressive movies, but made by major filmmakers, released by major studios. So there was obviously something culturally going on that made that somehow desirable or permissible. And and even in like the French Connection or Dirty Harry came out that year, or on another level, Harold and Maude. These were all, I mean, I guess they were all somewhat in the wake of the counterculture and appealing to youth culture. Obviously, that's what The Clockwork Orange is doing. So yeah, I think it did obviously arrive from that moment. And it's interesting you mentioned 2001, because I think the film does rhyme with 2001 a little bit. Like there's, the whole scene that's in slow motion where Alex beats up the other droogs does feel like a self-conscious riff on the apes in 2001, using a bone as a weapon for the first time. And of course the use of classical music, and there's even the old drunk who gets beaten up at the beginning talks about men in space and walking on the moon and no attention paid to earthly matters. And that also feels rather like a self-referential line.
That's
But
correct.
in a not in a cute way, but in a smart way. Like he's kind of making a point of, oh, this is one kind of science fictional world, but here's another one. And I guess people even have theories that, like, well, actually they do take place in the same time and universe, that, well, that seems a bit silly. But yeah, it's interesting how those two films relate to each other. And it's interesting now, one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast about Clockwork Orange is specifically because people don't talk about Clockwork Orange anymore, because I think it's fallen on a little bit on the side of being politically incorrect or scary. And frequently when I now hear, Kubrick's oeuvre mentioned, somehow Clockwork Orange seems sometimes to be left off the list or not highlighted. Like when I was growing up, which by that time Kubrick had finished making most of his movies, it was always like Clockwork Orange was like a mentioned in the same breath as 2001 and Dr. Strangelove. And now I feel like it's The Shining, 2001, Dr. Strangelove, maybe Barry Lyndon, but is Clockwork Orange always on that list? Not always. So I think that the film is, as much as it maybe speaks to this moment or feels resonant at this moment, is also a little bit of a pariah.
Do you think it's linked to the, sorry to
Go ahead.
interrupt. Do you think it's so linked to the aesthetics of the film or to the themes that are explored by Kubrick?
I think that it is because it has a particularly male perspective and is very unkind to women. And I mean, there are no women in the movie who aren't laughed at or treated horribly. And I'm not saying the film is a misogynist film. I don't think it is. But I could see someone reading it that way or objecting to it on those grounds, that just having a bad feeling. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sad to hear about this kind of the canon being revisited in that way, though, because for me, growing up, it was such a cult classic, and my mother showed it to me when I was like 13 or 14 and said, you have to know this film, and it was so important at the time, and I'm sad to hear that.
It is complex. Sorry, no, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask you, Marissa, like, how do you feel about, obviously you don't have those feelings about it, but what's your perception of it?
It's super interesting what you said about watching it as a child, because being very young, I wasn't bothered by it at all the first time I watched it. And I loved the film so much as a teenager. I had a Clockwork Orange t-shirt and I had the soundtrack. I loved the film's music. I don't recall having any kind of real debate about the depiction of women or violence in the film. I must admit that I think it's still a very important film, but as an adult, it's a lot harder for me to watch. I can see what's problematic. And then we enter into that debate about, do you show what's problematic to raise people's consciousness about it? Or is it okay to reinforce that system by showing it? And I don't have all the answers to that. But I am very, very opposed to wiping away films or saying that it's no longer acceptable to show them. I think we should show them and have honest conversations about them And, you know, life is messy and complex, so we really need to dive into those questions instead of sort of running away from them and shunning certain films.
And if I may add, I recently read an article about the film that was tackling this question of the depiction of women, and that was making a point saying that, in fact, it's a film about homosexuality. It's a film about these men wanting to be with other men in a sadomasochistic way. And women are just as an excuse, as a prologue for what's happening next. And I thought that was a very interesting reading of the film, and there might be an element of truth to it.
Well, in Anthony Burgess wrote a book called The Wanting Seed, which deals with themes like that, where homosexuality is kind of the dominant sexuality in the world, and what does that mean? And so I think it's, yeah, I think that is. There is, and it's just like guys in a gang, like that's there. That's part of it. For sure it is. So it's interesting. I get, suspicious of like my own perceptions of things because of who I am and not, not necessarily seeing it from all sides, and not being sensitized the way I would be if it was a movie about a bunch of guys getting raped. Maybe I feel a little differently. But yes, but I'm bothered by the fact that maybe people are afraid to put the film in where I think it belongs in its canon, which is very high and is an extraordinary movie. I mean, I don't like calling movies perfect because I feel like even perfect movies are perfect because of their imperfections. But it is a kind of perfect movie to it. I think it does what it wants to do flawlessly, like beautifully. It takes, I mean, don't think anyone could have adapted that novel better than he did. It was the perfect melding of source material and filmmaker and then perfect casting. I mean, for better or worse, Malcolm McDowell will always be remembered for that role. He's so brilliant and iconic and unforgettable. And I felt like he kind of couldn't help but play variations of that character in so many other movies. I saw Caligula for the first time recently. And you can't help but see echoes of Alex Delarge and Caligula. And I presume some of that is self-conscious on his part, but yeah. So, and also I think the other thing that Clockwork Orange has that very few films have is this melding of pop culture with classical culture. It's a lovely mixture. And it's I love it when like highbrow and lowbrow are married together. When it's there are very few films that succeed in doing this. It holds a unique spot in film history for that reason.
Absolutely. And are there any special filmmaking techniques or editing techniques that really stand out to you as a filmmaker when you watch the film now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a movie that is playing with the medium. Like you can tell he's having fun making the movie. The scene with the girls in fast motion set to the William Tell overture, which is immediately followed by the slow motion scene where Alex takes out the other droogs, or shortly after. There's the scene in Alex's bedroom when he's listening to Beethoven's Fifth, then you see the dancing Jesus cut. In a way, it's almost like a Bruce Conner. There's a lot of Bruce Conner influence in there, who is an experimental filmmaker. And so it has the feeling of somebody who's playing with the medium. The medium feels very present. And of course, the fact that Alex is then shown films and stock footage. So there is a self-reflective component to it that really feels like this is a movie about good and evil, but it's also a movie about movies and movie making. So as a filmmaker, that's kind of thrilling to see. And then to see someone do it masterfully. the way Kubrick does. It's funny. I feel like after A Clockwork Orange, each film took longer to get made, and in some ways, progressively got less interesting. Like I think he was sort of at his zenith as a filmmaker when he made that movie, which was really supposed to be just a bridge between 2001 and Napoleon, which was going to be his next epic. This was the film he was making to, I don't know, pay the rent in between those two things. And then when Napoleon didn't happen, he did Barry Lyndon, which is an amazing, extraordinary film. But I somehow after that, I love, and of course, The Shining is one of my a very important movie to me. But it felt like that as a filmmaker, that's kind of when he was just at his absolute optimum.
It feels like it might have been the moment when he was the most like Alex, in a sense. I mean, the most of an anarchist himself, ready to break everything and to go wherever the wind was taking him, regardless of the environment, right?
100%. Yes, that's a brilliant statement. Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think he was his truest self. That's what it feels like. But it just feels like it's so funny is the movie, is upsetting to, but it's so much fun. I mean, it's just filled with life. It's filled with joy. I also feel the seeds of like Monty Python in it. It's a very particularly British humor that it was, and in fact, Terry Gilliam was supposed to do the opening title sequence for it. And I'm not sure why that didn't happen, but that kind of acerbic, almost absurdist British humor is really pregnant in that movie. A lot of things are pregnant in that film. I feel that movie is gave birth to a lot of other things in film and music and fashion. It just its influence just it was like tendrils that went out into the world and had such a massive impact on the overall culture. And then the book itself, like I was shocked when I read the book. I was like, when was this written? I think I'll have to double check here. I think it was 1962 was when it was published, which is astounding to me because it doesn't feel like a film that could be written or a book that could be written until at least the late 60s. So the book, I mean, the book was just is wildly ahead of its time as well. And so it's really quite extraordinary to me.
Yeah, but the fact that the film somehow is at the root of so many works that followed, I think, is mirrored in the film itself by the omnipresence of egg shapes and the Moloko milk. I mean, you have all of this relationship to the mother that is there. I mean, women are not there, but their potential to have babies is present in many shapes, isn't it?
No, it's well, I mean, yes, I think that's what I mean. Pauline Kael call him a German gynecologist, something like that. But like, it has like there's it's infused with sex, but from like a scientific perspective. Like in a completely unsexy way. Which in itself is kind of an innovation too. That it somehow is at a point, coming at a point in the culture or in the sexual revolution when sex ceases to be sexy. It's so omnipresent and yeah, so no, it's a and then you look at the costumes even too, right? The Droog's outfits with their cod pieces and everything's like kind of a sex joke and the giant phallus, of course.
It's almost as if it's sex from the space age, it looks like the sex that people could have in 2001, The Space Odyssey.
Absolutely. No, it's true. Well, and I think, John Barry was the production designer. John Barry, who then several years later would go on to be the production designer for Star Wars, who I think had a very strong influence in terms of how we see the future. Like how we, it's funny how movies influence design and technology. And I feel like he had a concrete effect on futurist design in the real world too, because of those movies. So it's on so many levels, I think the film is really running on all cylinders. It's such a, and then it's just very funny. I think at the end of the day, the movie is really a fantastic, terrible slash satire. And maybe that's the other thing it's interesting to note, and maybe why it kind of worked for us when we were kids, is that it is structured like a fairy tale. It is a fairy tale, or a parable. It's this very simple story where all the characters come around as they do in a fairy tale, like Alex does these terrible things to these people, and then the people come back, and it's narrated like a fairy tale, really. So it also has it also I feel like it's in some ways anticipating how movie storytelling became a little more fairy tale like and simpler, in the coming years. In the 1970s, late 60s, there was a real movement towards reality, British kitchen sink dramas and the Nouvelle Vague in France were all about let's capture real life on film. And I feel like Kubrick is going the opposite direction. Like he's going completely towards theater and artifice and opera and fairy tales. And that's when you're young, particularly, I think that's really captivating. Like when I was a kid, I didn't want to see reality.
Reality.
I wasn't really interested in that. It didn't resonate. And later on, it did. But I think on that level, the movie is quite innovative and ahead of its time.
The design is just so spectacular, and the color palette as well, in terms of the interiors. And of course, I mean, Kubrick is known for that use of patterns and clashing or parallel colors. But I think that that really just draws you in on a very sensual level. So it's interesting to me that someone like Pauline was saying that there's no sensuality in the film, that it's somehow devoid of that, because I think in terms of the sensorial qualities of the design, I mean, for me, it is a very sensual film.
Aesthetically unparalleled, like, and the way that he lenses everything, these really wide lenses, he shoots one point perspective, he has very linear camera moves. Like usually the camera's either moving out or in, or it's tracking, or it's moving laterally, but it's never going diagonally, and it's never moving in more than one direction. It's a very which is fairy tale like too, like in a way, in its kind of presentation is very simple, not simple to do, extremely hard to execute, but very clean and easy to read as a viewer. And I found that so captivating. I love the theatrical nature. It even feels like when the actors are acting, they're acting on stage, because a lot of the lines are delivered with a lot of volume, and they're in spaces that are like empty spaces, so there's an echo, and a lot of scenes have no music. It almost feels like we're watching a stage play being filmed. And there's something really exciting about that. And inclusive, like too, when it's that theatrical, it does feel a little like the filmmakers, nudging you, breaking down the fourth wall a little bit and pointing and nodding and in an inviting way, rather than a distancing way. So I no, I agree. I think it's the design aspect of it is thrilling, and that is in terms of the sound design and the music, which I of course have the Wendy Carlos soundtrack. I think there were two soundtracks. There's a film soundtrack that then somehow became unavailable, and then when I was a teenager, I got the Wendy Carlos soundtrack, which had music that wasn't even in the movie, some of the more experimental music that she did, electronic music. So I just think the film is just like a feast, and the I have a thing for brutalist architecture, but it's all brutalist architecture, and the compositions are like so bold and aggressive. Yeah, it's really it was quite extraordinary to see, and I th think taste has come around a little bit to it as well. It's sort of you can see like that's why I feel like it could have been made yesterday, really, and also because so many people imitate Stanley Kubrick at this point. But it take the film is very deliberate. I think that is also one of the things that I enjoy. Sometimes it's taxing, but I enjoy the deliberateness of the pacing, of the of the actual delivery of the lines. Like, there's that point where we're in the writer's house and Alex is ringing the doorbell, and you have the shot of Patrick McGee behind his typewriter, and he says, "What is something like? Who could that be?" At this time, and then the camera goes over, and the actress who plays his wife, I'm sorry, I don't know her name, she's waiting for the camera to get to her. Like, she doesn't answer in a natural way. It's just, and it feels the deliberateness of that, the artifice of that, I love. I think it's there's something really powerful and delicious about it.
And it's very interesting that you're mentioning this moment in the film because in relationship with the symmetry that you also mentioned, because you have two moments that take place at home, the place where Mr. Alexander is acting, and that's one at the beginning of the film and one at the end. And of course, the result is very different the second time he goes back there. So I was wondering if you had a theory about why this place is called home and why that person has basically the same name as Alex. I mean, there's Alexander Delarge, but there's Mr. Alexander, which it might be chance, but I don't think so if since it's Mr. Burgess who wrote the book.
Well, home, like the sign that says home is in the book. I was amazed when I read that. I was like, who thinks of that? Like, that was 1962. It's such a pop art conceit. It was so odd. I was sure that that was invented by Kubrick, but it's actually in the book. But I do think that that plays into this whole sort of, artificial fairy tale type style of storytelling, because home, just calling it home, they're giving you this generic name, makes it everybody's home. And I'm sure, as much as we are seeing things from Alex's perspective, and there's kind of like a sick humor in the whole home invasion scene, that was probably Stanley Kubrick's worst nightmare. Like, I'm willing to bet that he, especially after the film came out and like people were being murdered and claiming that they were influenced by his movie and there he was receiving death threats, like this, he was a very loving father and family man. He had an estate outside of London. This would be his worst possible nightmare. Like, the guy at the typewriter, Alex at the Mr. Alex at the typewriter, Patrick McGee, is Stanley Kubrick. Like, I think that's him. With his beautiful wife. Like, I feel like this is his worst nightmares. So oddly played from the perspective of the perpetrators rather than his point of view. But yeah, I don't know. That's so interesting. I don't know why the writer is named that. Maybe for that reason. I wonder, I didn't notice that in the book. So I feel like that was something that was added into the film.
And are there moments today in your own filmmaking where you can recognize anything that's a direct Kubrick influence, or would you say that Kubrick's films are just kind of there floating in your creative conscious because, that was formative for you at,
Oh, no. I mean, of course, I steal lift directly, frequently. I think his use of I like the graphical simplicity of his shooting style. Like, I like symmetrical compositions. I like single point perspective. I like wide lenses. I like it when everything's in focus and you're kind of in the world. I just find that like really appealing and compelling. And so I've, like many of my peers, I've directly lifted that from his films. And And the performances too, which tend to be grotesque and a little bit over the top, but compelling. I enjoy that too in my own movies when I find somebody who can do it well. So no, I feel like this movie it just is deeply baked into my identity as a filmmaker. It was like a very, I would definitely put it in the top 10 most influential movies for myself. I mean, with several other Kubrick films, but I think, and I'm sure he had his influences like Max Ophüls and people like that. But there was no one who really did what he did.
Can we ask what you're currently working on? What are your next projects are? Are you preparing a new movie currently?
Well, I'm trying to get movies made. I like three scripts that are very ready to be made, and I'm just waiting for somebody to agree with me. But it's an interesting time. I think it's such an exciting time in the world in general, and terrifying, of course, but exciting. And in the film world, it always feels like a microcosm of everything else. The film industry does too. So it's chaotic, like everything's falling apart. But I also feel like in this moment, it's also like a time of tremendous opportunity, and really interesting things are coming. Like, so I'm probably delusional, but I'm cautiously optimistic about the future of movies in general. And I don't know about myself, but I think that it's like the calcification of Hollywood, where just like, only certain kinds of movies can get made, and they're really lacking any kind of personal point of view. They feel so much like products, or they, not to be overly critical, because I think good things still get made, and there's nothing wrong with a good product, but I can tell there's a hunger for something exciting and new, and that will come. Somebody's going to do it. And or a lot of people will start doing it, and that's what I hope for the future, and hope for myself. But yeah, like you think about 1971, like what a fantastic year of movies that was. That time was just so thrilling, and it came after, I mean, people talk about this endlessly, but the mid 60s was a terrible time for Hollywood. They were lost and confused, and nothing was working. And that's why those films emerged, and because there was an audience that was craving something that spoke to them. And I just feel like movies now, at least theatrical films, like Hollywood movies, are comfort food for people. It's just like a reason to go out and have a nice time. But I don't know that they resonate. And so I and this is such an interesting time right now. Maybe we need to get past it. Maybe it's too interesting for people to want to see challenging stuff, but at some point we will get past that, and then people will be starved for, another Stanley Kubrick to show up.
Yes, and they'll dive into all of this kind of collective trauma we've been living through.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. I think it's going to be very interesting what happens in the next 10, 5, 10 years in the, I mean, in everything, but in the film world in particular. I think media is going to go through some weird transformational stuff.
And how do you feel about working today with streaming? I mean, you've recently worked on a series, so I'm just curious in terms of format and practicalities. How do you feel about that? Do you enjoy the temporality of working on a series?
I love doing television. Like television, first of all, television saved me financially. I sort of reached a point in my life where like I had to do something to make money because movies weren't doing it. And so I started doing TV, only to discover that in fact, I found it really fulfilling artistically. That's what I wasn't expecting. I thought I was just doing a job. But I found it really exciting to work with other people's material and kind of freeing. It was sort of liberating to kind of be free of myself sense. And I feel like some of my better work as a director has actually been on TV. Having said that, I really want to do my own things too. And the Peripheral was like that, because that was kind of my show. But I mean, I did it. It was a collaboration, but it was still, it started with me. And and streaming too. Like, I know there's a lot of film purists out there that think it's terrible, and I see their point, but I also think there's something liberating about it too. And one of the exciting things about film is that it's a technologically evolving art form. It's not static. In fact, I think we should fear it becoming static, because when it becomes static, then it may cease to be a popular art and kind of, I don't think it'll ever go away, but it would just end up kind of in this corner. And I very much want movies to be the apex predator of the art world, of culture. And when I say movie, I mean, I think TV and movies are sort of blending. They're not the same thing. And my last film was made with Netflix, and I had a great experience. It was like creatively not restricted in any way and felt very supported. And the only thing for me is I really personally love to see movies in a movie theater. And I don't think you can replicate that at home. I think the home experience can be a good experience, but it's a different kind of experience. It's a more intimate, can be lovely, but it's an intimate experience. Whereas the collective experience of seeing a film with a group of people, which is basically like going to church. You're in a dark room with one purpose, shared purpose with a group of people, and you have this communal experience which goes outside of just who you are, influenced not by just the movie you're seeing, but like the p other people in the room is a really, I don't think you can beat that as just like a mind expanding, heart expanding experience. And that's personally how I like to see films and how I would like my movies to be seen if I could. But I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive, and I think they can kind of work in tandem and support each other. And I don't know if you're seeing this in France, but certainly here in Toronto, my city, in around North America, there are a lot of cinemas that are showing older films, but are attended by young people. Like there's a, I think a another, it's almost like an alternative exhibition form of exhibit film exhibition that's emerging that is really popular and is for young audiences that outside of the mainstream, that is kind of not interested in like the more generic stuff that's playing in, most movie theaters, mainstream movie theaters. So that to me is exciting. I can see that is something that's growing, and that kind of film culture is really that's a new, I feel like that's always been there, but now it's stepping up to another level. That's very exciting.
That's so encouraging to hear. I think in France it's pretty stable in terms of having access to classics and having real respect for film culture. But I am rather dismayed with my international students who come from all over the world. And, I'll make references to what I think are kind of essential classics, and they've never seen them before. They haven't seen Hitchcock. They don't know their movie musicals. So that's been a bit depressing as I've taken on a film studies scholarship.
I'm sure it is. Or they've seen like the YouTube Cole's Notes version.
And I'll say, okay, who here has seen Rear Window? Maybe one hand goes up, and I'm lucky if that.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I might have a distorted perspective. I will say something I'm proud of in this city is like we're a very film literate city and a film loving city. It's for whatever reason, it's just always been the case. Yeah, but also what that generation considers an old film is not really old to us. Like Hitchcock would be ancient history. But if you said Brian De Palma, maybe a few more hands would come up. Maybe. I don't
Well,
know, maybe not.
the other day I made a reference to Kill Bill and I got blank looks in the room. And then one of the students said, "Oh, yeah, it's old, but it's good."
What, sorry, which film did you blanked out there for a sec?
Oh, Kill Bill.
Okay, that's old. That's I know. Well, I guess it is old. Golly.
Anyway,
I think it's an interesting time. I think that the arrival of AI is going to have some crazy effect on filmmaking. But I don't know. I'm sort of in, I get crucified for this, but I'm kind of in favor of it. But like, I think that we need it, just everything has to keep evolving, right? Like, everything, I do feel like movies have started to stagnate a little bit. I mean, there's lots of great films that still get made, but they're mostly foreign films or independent films. I think mainstream cinemas are in a really bad place right now, and on a lot of levels. But I see like this something. I see all this young talent. I see so many talented young people out there, and I feel like with all these new tools that are emerging technologically, and that something interesting is coming.
I agree with you. I know that it's not well seen somehow to say that you are excited by the arrival of AI, and I understand that there's a lot of problems going along with it about authors' rights and copyrights and all of this. But I have also seen some works done with AI, which I find quite amazing, and they're not quite there yet, but I think that they can also in the future help us produce some very amazing results. That's my feeling anyway, and my hope. And
Yeah.
is that also the way you feel about AI, or are you a bit more cautious,
I
perhaps?
think so. Yeah, I'm speaking specifically of like AI graphics. AI is like a huge thing. It's very complicated, but AI in filmmaking, first of all, the whole copyright thing they're going to get past because they're already training AIs to on copyrighted material that they own, not stuff that's scrubbed from the net and that's stolen. So they're going to work around, they're already working around that. That's not going to become as much of an issue. Yeah, I agree, Ronk. I think it's going to allow people to do all sorts of things, including giving them a hunger for the real thing. Like, I think that, again, these things can coexist. I think that AI, there'll be hybrid things that are partly real. Humans and augmented stuff. There'll be stuff that's just AI, and then there'll be things where they're like, there was no AI used, where the disclaimer will show up at the beginning for all the people who are sick of looking at AI imagery that does things the old-fashioned way. And so I think anything that I think movies need are ready for some kind of injection of something new. I think the whole world is in obviously in this flux state, and yeah, I agree with you. I'm not cynical about it. I actually am fairly optimistic. I think it's been hugely disruptive, and film is one of the last mediums that is handmade, one of the last things that we make that is entirely handmade. So I certainly don't want to see that go away, and I sort of be disruptive in terms of professions and jobs and craftsmen who did great things and are not able to do it as much, just like when, CG. Like, I lament the arrival of CG in some ways because I used to love visual effects. And now they're not interesting to me anymore because they're just, they're not handmade as much. But they somehow that's still, people still build miniatures and they still do stop motion and they still do makeup effects, and I think these things can coexist, and And some there will be a little Stanley Kubrick who in his bedroom makes the most amazing thing you've ever seen with text prompts and his friends. I think some kid's going to come along and do something that just blows our minds at some point.
You've been extremely generous with your time. Usually on the podcast, we end by asking our guests a question, which is there a question you wish we had asked, something that you wish we had asked and haven't asked?
Oh my goodness, I'm not bad with I'm bad at asking questions. I'm probably not very good at giving answers either. Really bad at asking questions. I don't know.
You've been great so far.
I know. I don't. I just don't. I don't have anything interesting to say. Like I think you, we've been you've been very effective at covering A Clockwork Orange, and we just talked about the subject I'm most interested in right now, which is AI.
Oh, fantastic, too. Yeah.
I'm feeling very complete here.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Okay.
Thank you very much for this discussion. Vincenzo, it was a real pleasure to chat with you tonight, our time, and I guess a bit earlier your time. We are really looking forward to your next projects. We are really eager to see what's going to come next from you.
Yes, thank you so
Oh,
much.
thank you. Oh, such a pleasure, Frank. Such a pleasure, Mr.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images Podcast on social media.